Up next, an interview with retired NASA astronaut Mike Mullane.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was rolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
Counter, go and throttle up.
The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
An interview with retired astronaut Mike Mullane. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. Mike was born on September 10th of 1945 in Wichita Falls, Texas, but considers Albuquerque, New Mexico to be his hometown. Mike graduated from high school in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1963 and received a Bachelor of Science degree in Military Engineering from the United States Military Academy in 1967. And awarded a Master of Science degree in Aeronautical Engineering from the Air Force Institute of Technology in 1975. Colonel Mullane was awarded 6 Air Medals, the Air Force Distinguished Flying Cross, Meritorious Service Medal, Vietnam Campaign Medal, National Defense Service Medal, Vietnam Service Medal, and Air Force Commendation Medal, and NASA Space Flight Medal. Named a distinguished graduate of United States Air Force Navigator Training School and recipient of the Commander's Trophy, the Air Force Institute of Technology, and the United States Air Force Test Pilot School. Air Force Colonel Mullane was graduated from West Point in 1967. He completed 150 combat missions as an RF-4C weapon system operator while stationed in Vietnam from January to November of 1969. He subsequently served a 4-year tour of duty in England. In July of 1976, upon completing the United States Air Force Flight Test Engineering course at Edwards Air Force Base in California, he was assigned as a Flight Test Weapon System Operator to the 3246th Test Wing at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. Selected by NASA in January of 1978, Mullane became an astronaut in August of 1979. A veteran of 3 space flights, he has logged a total of 356 hours in space. Colonel Mullane retired from NASA and the United States Air Force in September of 1990. He is a professional speaker and writer and resides in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mullane's spaceflight experience included STS-41D on board Discovery, launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on August the 30th of 1984. This was the maiden flight of Orbiter Discovery. During the 7-day mission, the crew successfully deployed 3 satellites. STS-41D completed 96 orbits of the Earth in 145 hours before landing at Edwards Air Force Base in California on September the 5th, 1984. His second mission was STS-27 on board Space Shuttle Atlantis, launched on December the 2nd, 1988. The mission carried a Department of Defense payload as well as a number of secondary payloads. After 68 orbits of the Earth, the mission concluded with a dry lake bed landing on runway 17 at Edwards Air Force Base in California on December the 6th, 1988. The mission duration was 105 hours. Mullane's third flight was on board Atlantis, STS-36, launched on February 28th, 1990. This mission carried Department of Defense payloads together with a number of secondary payloads. After 72 orbits of the Earth, the mission concluded with a lakebed landing at Edwards Air Force Base in California on March 4th, 1990. We're speaking with retired NASA astronaut Mike Mullane. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Well, I'm happy to do it.
As a fellow Air Force retiree, I have to ask you what your call sign was.
Actually, you'd be surprised. And when I was in the Air Force, we didn't have call signs. That only came about later. I was in the Air Force in the early... Well, I guess I got in at 67 and got out from the operational era in about 70, 75, I guess, 74. So, it just wasn't something they had back then. It came about later.
That's interesting. So, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I never was knowing that none of the crews that we flew with had any, I flew with back then, had any type of call signs. That was, I think, maybe the movie Top Gun brought that about with Maverick and Goose. I don't know where it came from, but maybe the Navy had it longer and it was adapted by the Air Force. I don't know.
Okay, well, I got my dumb question of the day out of the way.
There are no dumb questions.
Only the ones I don't ask, right?
Well, hey, by the way, thanks for your service. I forgot that you were former Air Force, so thanks for your service.
Oh, not at all. It was an honor, and I do miss it, and I still keep in touch with my squadron mates.
Good. And by the way, any listeners who are vets, I'd like to thank you for your services, too.
Well, they appreciate your thanks, and I'm sure that they're honored as well. How were you selected to be an astronaut?
Well, that's kind of a long story, but I'll give you the Reader's Digest version of it. Early in my life, I wanted to be an astronaut. I was a child of the space race. I was 12 years old when Sputnik was launched in 1957. Shortly after that, the original seven Mercury astronauts were in the news constantly. Al Shepard, John Glenn, and those folks. And I wanted to be them. And so I was headed in a career that definitely was going to put me in the space program somehow. I loved science. I loved engineering. I loved rockets. Obviously, being an astronaut was a long shot, but I went to West Point, graduated from there, ultimately went to West Point, graduated from there, intending to go into the Air Force to be a test pilot and an astronaut, but I couldn't be an astronaut. My eyesight was too poor. In fact, my flying career in the Air Force was in the back seat of fighters, wasn't in the front seat. And in 1967, when I was put in the back seat of fighters, I knew my dream of being an astronaut was over because NASA only selected pilots. But then, so I went to graduate school. I did some other things, always intending that when I left the Air Force, I'd be working somewhere in the space program. But then in 1977, NASA announced the selection for the new space shuttle, and they had a new crew position called Mission Specialist Astronaut, and you did not need to be a pilot to apply to the Mission Specialist position. Mission Specialists are the people that use the robot arm, do spacewalks, things like that. And so I immediately put an application in and was fortunate enough to get selected in the first group of Mission Specialist Astronauts for the space shuttle. Unfortunately, I never did a spacewalk. I would have loved to have done a spacewalk. Got to use a robot arm, but did some other very interesting things, but no spacewalk. We didn't do a lot of that when I was flying.
Well, you didn't have to worry about getting an itch while you're on a six-hour EVA.
Yeah, I guess that's true, too. And for the listeners out there, I flew three times on the shuttle. In sequence, there were 135 ultimate shuttle flights. I flew on the 12th, 27th, and on the 34th mission, although the 34th mission is actually labeled STS-36. There was some flights ahead of us that were delayed, so even though we were supposed to fly 36 in order, we flew 34th in order, so... And two of those missions, the last two missions, were secret military missions that I can't talk about.
Well, they did kind of mess up the sequence, and then when they started to go with 41A and 51B and stuff like that, it was rather confusing at the time. But then they...
Well, actually, I heard a rumor, and I don't doubt it, that we were going up in order. It originally started out STS-1, STS-2, STS so forth. Well, then when they realized that STS-13 was coming up, and engineers are just as superstitious as everybody else, they decided to go to more of a coded numbering system. And I don't know if that was coincidence that 13 was coming up or not. I don't doubt it. But what they were intending at that time to start fly out of the West Coast, out of Vandenberg Air Force Base on military missions, as well as out of Kennedy on the civilian missions, and so they wanted some information within those flight designations that would allow people to know which site they were going out, either California or Florida, and which order in the calendar year, and that's where all that number and letter stuff came up with to give that information.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired NASA astronaut Mike Mullane. Mike, what was your training process before the first mission on the maiden flight of Space Shuttle Discovery in 1984?
Well, you start out in simulators, just like the Air Force or operating any complex system. They start with single systems trainers where you'll sit in an office and they'll have somebody instructing you on how the hydraulic system works. And then they'll have similar instruction for the electrical system. And then they might have environmental control system and the reaction control system, the propulsion system. They'll single systems train you. And then you graduate into a full-up motion-based simulator. It's in a building in Houston. It was on six hydraulic legs, and it was just a box, but inside, when you climbed into it, it looked like a shuttle. All the instruments and displays and everything looked just like you were in a shuttle. And they had over the windows, they had some crude, at the time, crude computer generated images. They were very crude. It wouldn't be like what you'd see today in movies and video games and stuff. But basically, when you got in that, it was like a full-up space shuttle as far as the instrumentation went and the displays. And then they would have instructors who would be in other rooms and would electronically introduce malfunctions into the various systems, and you'd be trained to react to those malfunctions. And when you get closer to launch, you started doing integrated simulations with mission control. So they were tied in electronically. They were seeing everything as if you were actually flying in space, and the instructors would be introducing malfunctions that mission control and the crew would have to simultaneously troubleshoot. So you spend hundreds and hundreds of hours in simulators is the short answer to your question to get ready to fly.
Sounds rather tedious at best.
Well, actually, I don't think it ever got tedious. The ones where we were by ourselves and mission control was linked in were more dynamic, because when mission control was linked in, it was like a mission. You would do these multiple day simulations like you're actually in orbit, and some of these malfunctions would develop over several days and they'd have to react to it. And I found those kind of slow in the cockpit compared to the times when we were in the cockpit just as a crew by ourselves and not integrated with mission control. But certainly it's critical to be prepared for the mission to have these integrated simulations. It was never a drudgery. You knew that this was preparing you for the real thing.
Could you describe the experience of launch, and where were you seated on Discovery?
On Discovery, I was seated behind the pilot, which in common terms, most people would say that's the co-pilot. We call it a commander, who's in the left front seat, and a pilot, who's in the right front seat, as opposed to pilot and co-pilot, like in the Air Force or commercial world, commander and pilot in the shuttle. At any rate, the pilot, I was sitting directly behind that pilot on the right side as a mission specialist. And when the engines start, you get this heavy vibration in the cockpit. Those are started 6 seconds early so they can be checked by computers to make sure they're all working. Those are the liquid-fueled engines. And then assuming they pass all their checks, a command is issued to explode some bolts that are holding the vehicle to the pad. And simultaneously, the solid rocket boosters are ignited, and you lift off. And you're slapped into your seat with a force of about 2 times gravity as the rocket leaps off the launch pad. A lot of noise, a lot of vibration, as you might imagine. But then 2 minutes up, when the boosters burn out and separate, it gets glass smooth. At about 2 minutes up, you'll hear a loud bang. You'll see this fire across the windscreens as these boosters are pyrotechnically separated. And then it's like a light switch. It gets dead quiet. You're up above 99% of the atmosphere at that point, so you don't have shock waves vibrating the vehicle. You don't have those big boosters next to you. They're roaring, and so it's glass smooth for the next 6.5 minutes with the liquid-fueled engine still running. You can only see that the only physical sense you have, you're even moving, are the G-forces building on your body, and those ultimately stabilize at 3 Gs. And then this all takes 8.5 minutes from liftoff to engine stop, and you're in orbit. So it's a nice ride. It's scary, but it's a great ride.
Well, it's definitely an e-ticket, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Most people wouldn't know what that means anymore.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I think that one went away in about 1983 or so.
That e-ticket ride is something that throws back to the early Disney World rides. You get an e-ticket as the top premium ticket to take all of the real big roller coasters and such.
What were your duties on that mission, and what was a typical day schedule for you?
Okay, on that mission, the first mission, it was a commercial communication satellite launch. We had three communication satellites. One was actually for the U.S. Navy. It was an unclassified communication satellite for the Navy, and then two others were strictly commercial communication satellites. So the job was that you got in orbit, you checked these satellites out, you prepared the shuttle in position and attitude to release these things into space, throw in a couple switches, and you did that on sequential days. Just one day, and the next day, and the third day. And then we also had a large solar panel prototype that was being tested to extend 120 feet out of the cargo bay. That was an early test of what they were going to do ultimately for the International Space Station. But a typical day was they would schedule an about a 7-hour sleep period. You wake up, have some food, dehydrated food, and then just start with what they call the crew activity plan. Everything was laid out at what time you did what. And you just follow that. There might be some in-cockpit experiments, medical experiments. And, of course, the payloads occupied at least a half a day, I would guess, there, trying to get those things ready to go and deploy. So it was just housekeeping, maintenance, experiments. Then you repeat the next day. We did not do any. None of my missions had shift operations. They were short missions. The shuttle only flew short missions. And we all slept at the same time, all worked at the same time. Whereas on the International Space Station and these other longer science lab missions on the shuttle, they might have had bigger crews and run shift operations, but we didn't do that on any of my missions.
Could you please describe the working and sleeping conditions on the shuttle?
Well, the sleeping's bizarre. Weightlessness, frankly, is bizarre. You can't really prepare for it. NASA tries to give us a little taste of it in that roller coaster C-135, that old Boeing 707, basically.
Flying the Vomit Comet.
Yeah, the Vomit Comet, exactly. But that only gives you 30 seconds, and it really is useless, frankly, for preparing you for what continuous zero-G is like. Frankly, continuous zero-G is much more comfortable than that Vomit Comet, and I was sick on that thing all the time, whereas on the up in space, I didn't have any sickness. So, but the sleeping, for example, you can't lay down up there. There's no such thing. In fact, when you think about it, there's a lot of words in our vocabulary that are meaning, because they're gravity related, are meaningless up in weightlessness. For example, in weightlessness, you can't sit, stand, lay down. You can't drop anything, spill anything, pour anything. So you have to adapt to that environment. And sleeping, we just zip ourselves into some that look like sleeping bags, but we call them sleep restraints because you're not laying in them. They're just pinned to the wall and restraining you from drifting around the cockpit while you're asleep. So that's how you do that. Well, it's bizarre there is if you wake up in the middle of your sleep period and look around, you'll see people who have fallen asleep and their arms float out in front of them, which is weird to look at. Look like they're in suspended animation, but the toilet operation, same thing, complicated because nothing will flow. You can't use water up there for waste collection, and so that's a vacuum cleaner, basically, our toilet is, and it's a pain to use, as you might imagine, particularly for solid waste collection. It really takes a long, long time to do that function. Frankly, even urine collection is a lot of overhead associated with habitability things in weightlessness. And frankly, for those habitability things, sleeping, using the toilet, preparing food, you would dearly love to be able to snap your fingers and be back in a gravity vector. It makes everything so much easier because you're up there, you're constantly, you just a lot of preparation for the toilet and for the food, frankly, the dehydrated food. It'd be nice not to have to to fiddle with that stuff. But working up there, it's the downstairs is pretty roomy. Upstairs is kind of crowded. But there was only 5 or 6 crew members on my flight, so in weightlessness, it never really felt all that crowded because you could use the volume above you. Seemed every all the shuttle which we were on Earth practicing in all of a sudden seemed much roomier in weightlessness.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired NASA astronaut Mike Mullane. After 2 more flights, you retired from NASA. You've been pretty busy ever since. How do you pass your time now?
Well, I left NASA after my 3 flights, and I flew once before Challenger, twice after. People have that milestone in mind. Older people are familiar with the space shuttle program. But I left in 1990 after my 3rd mission, and my intention was to become the next Tom Clancy and write techno thrillers. Well, let me tell you, folks, don't quit your day job if you want to be an author, because that's a tough, tough business to get into, and I failed at it. I wrote a very popular nonfiction book, my life story, called Riding Rockets. I've got that out there, and that's been very, very popular. And by the way, that is available, I think. I know it is. The Library of Congress on the Vision Impaired program, that's available out there for people to be able to listen to. So you might enjoy that. It tells you a lot more about my life. But as I was trying to be a novelist and failing, I started speaking on safety to various corporations, and that business took off. So basically it became more or less a full time is a little exaggeration, but a significant amount of my time was devoted to be on the road to talk to corporations about safety.
Well, I'll throw in one more question before I have the last question, which you're going to love. It'll be a curveball for you. And don't worry, I don't ask how you go to the bathroom in space.
Hey, I don't care. You can ask. I think I answered it, kind of. But,
I've been in the simulator, and they explained to me the technicalities and the targeting. I don't want to get into that.
Yeah.
But I'm going to throw one in real quick, and I know we're up against it here. What is wrong with your first name?
What, the Richard, you mean?
Yeah. What's wrong with Richard?
Yeah, yeah. See, Rick, you're probably wondering about that. Actually, I don't know. My parents bizarrely named us, in my case, Richard Michael Mullane, but I was called Mike by my parents all the time. My dad preferred that. I was named when my dad was at war. I was born just after the end of World War II. My dad had been deployed for 9 months before that, so he wasn't home when I was named, and he liked calling me Michael, so that name stuck. And where I started, when I went to West Point, though, of course, you don't have nicknames or anything. I was given a name badge that said Richard Mullane, so in all my years at West Point, I was called Dick, Richard, Rick. Occasionally, somebody knew me as Mike, and so to this day now, whenever I hear somebody holler Rick or Dick, I'll turn around thinking it might be somebody calling for me, so I answered anything.
Especially with not to be late for dinner, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
Okay, well, this is our last question. Now, I saved this one for all of our guests. It's the most important question. It's a two-parter. What's your favorite food? And what do you want for Christmas?
Are you in space? If you're asking about that, my favorite food was M&Ms or butter cookies, equally great. There's nothing better than to sit at the window and look down at the Earth from a couple hundred miles up in a relaxing moment and be eating M&Ms or butter cookies. That's heaven. Heaven is, you know, just a heavenly experience. As far as on Earth goes, I'm not really a food fanatic. My wife's an excellent cook. I tell you, I would love to eat a big giant plate of pasta. She's Italian, or second generation American Italian, but full-blooded Italian, so she's a great cook. But unfortunately, we both know at our age we can't eat a lot of pasta without having it stay with us for the rest of our lives. We've got to be a little bit circumspect about chowing down on that.
And what do you want for Christmas?
Well, actually, I want my family with me. I my wife and I have long been in the mode now. We don't want any gifts, so we got everything. In fact, we're in the mode now at age, I'm 73, CS2. We're in the mode of trying to get rid of things in the house. So it's kind of knowing a short horizon awaits in the future, and we'd like to get a lot of this stuff out of the house, things that we've collected over the years. And so we tell our kids, we don't want any gifts whatsoever. Just send us a card. And my wife and I might exchange some small stocking stuffers and a card or so, but that's about it. Just being with family is what it's all about. I got 3 children and 6 grandkids, and I just love being with them for the holidays.
Well, that's the ultimate gift, if you will, being with family.
Yeah, that and good health.
Right. Well, Colonel, thank you so much for your time. It means so much to present spaceflight history from words of pioneers like yourself. From Sun Sounds of Arizona, Godspeed, and from the Air Force, aim high.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And again, all you vets listening, thank you. Thank you for your service. God bless you all.
Thank you. God bless. An interview with retired astronaut Mike Mullane. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you on the good Earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.